You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of four essays of Rudolf Steiner entitled The Stages of Higher Knowledge, Imagination, Inspiration, Intuition. This is essay number one, entitled The Stages of Higher Knowledge. In my book, titled How to Know Higher Worlds, the path to higher knowledge has been traced up to the meeting with the two guardians of the threshold. The relation in which the soul stands to the different worlds as it passes through the successive stages of knowledge will now be described. What will be given may be called, quote, the teachings of esoteric science, close quote. Before you enter the path of higher knowledge, you know only the first of four stages of cognition. This stage is the one you occupy in ordinary life in the world of the senses. Even in what is called science, we deal only with this first stage of knowledge. For science merely elaborates ordinary cognition more minutely and in a disciplined way. Aided by instruments, the microscope, the telescope, and so forth, the senses examine their surroundings with greater exactness than they could without these aids. Yet people remain at the same stage of cognition, whether they see large things with the naked eye or observe small objects and phenomena with the aid of a microscope. Also, in the application of thinking to facts and things, this science remains in the realm of everyday life. People arrange objects, describe and compare them, try to imagine their variations, and so forth. The keenest scientists do nothing fundamentally in this respect, but develop to a fine art the methods of observing everyday life. Their knowledge embraces a wider range, becomes more complex and more logical, but they do not proceed to another mode of cognition. In esoteric science, this first stage of knowledge is called the, quote, material mode of cognition, close quote. This is followed by three higher stages, and there are still others beyond these. These stages of knowledge shall be described here before proceeding with the description of the, quote, path of knowledge, close quote. Considering the ordinary method of scientific cognition, of apprehension through the senses as the first stage, we shall differentiate the following four stages. Number one, material knowledge. Number two, imaginative knowledge. Number three, inspirational knowledge, parenthesis, which may also be called, quote, of the nature of will, close quote, parenthesis close. And number four, intuitive knowledge. These stages will be discussed here. It must first be made quite clear what is significant in these different modes of cognition. In ordinary sensory knowledge, four elements are to be considered. Number one, the object, which makes an impression upon the senses. Number two, the image, which the human being forms of this object. Number three, the concept, through which the human being arrives at a spiritual comprehension of an object or an event. Four, the capital I, which forms for itself the image and concept based on the impression of the object. Before people make for themselves an image or representation, an object is there that causes it. We do not form the object, but perceive it. And on the basis of the object, the image arises. As long as we are looking at the object, at an object, we are dealing with the thing itself. The moment we turn away from it, we are left with only the image. The object is relinquished, the image is retained in the memory. But one cannot stop here at the image-making stage. One must go on to concepts. The distinction between image and concept is absolutely necessary if we are to be clear at this point. Suppose one sees an object of circular form. Then, one turns away and retains the picture of the circle in memory. So far, one has not yet the concept of the circle. We attain this concept only when we say to ourselves, quote, "A circle is a figure in which all points are equidistant from the center." Close quote. Understanding of a thing is attained only when we have formed a concept of it. There are all kinds of circles, small, large, red, blue, and so forth. But there is only one concept circle. All these things will be approached more closely. For the moment, it will suffice to sketch what is necessary to characterize the first four stages of knowledge. The fourth element to consider in material cognition is the eye, in which a union of images and concepts is produced. The eye stores the image in memory. Otherwise, a continuing inner life would be impossible. Images of things would remain only so long as the things themselves affected the soul. But the inner life depends on linking one perception with another. The eye directs itself to the world today because in the presence of certain objects, images from yesterday of similar objects arise. It is obvious that soul life would be impossible if the image of a thing could be held only as long as the thing itself was present. In relation to concepts also, the eye forms the unity. It combines its concepts and so makes a survey, evokes an understanding of the world. This linking of concepts is what occurs in, quote, "forming judgments," close quote. A being having only loosely connected concepts would not find a way in the world. All human activity depends on our capacity to combine concepts, that is, to form judgments. The material mode of cognition rests on the fact that human beings receive impressions through the senses of things and representations of the outer world. We have the power of sensing, or sensibility. The impression received from outside is also called sensation. Therefore, in material cognition, four elements have to be considered: sensation, image, concept, and capital I. At the next higher stage of knowledge, the impression made upon the outer senses, the sensation, falls away. There is no longer any outer sensory object. Of the elements to which we are accustomed in ordinary knowledge, there remains only the three: image, concept, and I. Ordinary knowledge in a healthy individual does not create an image or concept unless an object confronts the outer senses. The I then remains inactive. Anyone who forms images for which the corresponding sensory objects do not actually exist, lives in fantasy. But esoteric students acquire this very faculty of forming images without the stimulus of external sensory objects. With them, something else must take the place of outer objects. They must be able to form images, although no object touches their senses. Something must step in to replace sensation. This something is imagination. At this stage, images appear to the esoteric student in exactly the same way as if a sensory object were making an impression. They are as vivid and true as sensory images, yet they are not of material but of soul-spirit origin. Yet the senses remain entirely inactive. It is evident that individuals must first acquire this faculty of forming meaningful images without sense impressions. This is accomplished through meditation and through the exercises that have been described in the book titled How to Know Higher Worlds. Those who are confined to the sensory world live only among images that have reached them through the senses. Those who are imaginative have a world of images received from a higher source. Careful training is needed to distinguish illusion from reality in this higher image world. When such images first enter our soul, we tend to say, "Ah, that's just fancy, a mere product of my thought life." This is quite understandable, for people today are accustomed to calling real only what is given on the certain basis of sensory evidence with no effort on their part. They must first become accustomed to accepting things that originate from a different side as real. In this respect, we cannot guard too carefully against becoming visionaries. The capacity to determine what is real and what is illusionary in these higher regions comes only from experience, and such experience must become our own in a quiet, patient inner life. We must be fully prepared to expect the tricks that illusion plays upon us. Everywhere, the possibility lurks that images will emerge from delusions of the outer senses or of abnormal life. All such possibility must first be done away with. One must first completely close off the sources of fantasy. Only thus can one come to imagination. At this point, it will be clear that the world that one has entered in this way is not only just as real as the world of sense, but much more real. At the third stage of knowledge, images no longer appear. We now have to deal only with concept and I. Whereas, at the second stage, a world of images still surrounds us, a reminder from the moment when a vivid memory instantaneously generated impressions from the outer world without our actually having had such impressions, at the third stage, such images are no longer present. We live wholly in a purely spiritual world. Those accustomed to holding strictly to the senses will be tempted to believe that this world is pale and ghostly, but that is not at all the case. Nothing about the world of images at the second stage is pale or shadowy, unlike the images that remain in memory after the outer objects are no longer present. However, the pictures of imagination have vivacity and comprehensiveness that do not compare to the shadowy memory pictures of the sensory world, even those of the glittering and ephemeral physical world itself. Yet, this too is only a shadow compared to the realm of imagination. Now, the world of the third stage of knowledge. Nothing in the sensory world can even suggest its wealth and abundance. What was sensation at the first stage of cognition, imagination at the second, here becomes inspiration. Inspiration gives the impressions, and the I forms the concepts. If anything in the sensory realm can be compared with this world of inspiration, it is the world of tone opened to us by our sense of hearing. Here, however, we are not dealing with the tones of earthly music, but purely spiritual tones. One begins to hear, in quotes, what is going on at the heart of things. The stone, the plant, and so on, become spiritual words. The world begins to express its true nature to the soul. It sounds strange, but it is actually true that at this stage of knowledge we, quote, hear spiritually the grass growing. Close quote. A crystal form is perceived as sound. An opening blossom speaks to us. Those who are inspired can proclaim the inner nature of things. Everything rises before the soul as though from the dead in a new kind of way. They speak a language that stems from another world, and that alone can make the everyday world comprehensible. Finally, at the fourth stage of knowledge, inspiration also ceases. Of the elements customarily observed in everyday knowledge, the I alone remains to be considered. The attainment of this stage by the esoteric student is marked by a definite inner experience. This experience manifests in the feeling that we no longer stand outside the things and events that we recognize, but within them. The image is not the object, but merely its imprint. Neither does inspiration yield the object itself, but only tells of it. But what now lives in the soul is in reality the object itself. The I has flowed forth over all beings. It has merged with them. The actual living of things within the soul is intuition. When it is said of intuition that, quote, through it we slip gradually into all things, close quote, this is literally true. In ordinary life, we have only one intuition, namely that of the I itself, for the I can in no way be perceived externally. It can be experienced only in the inner life. A simple consideration will make this fact clear. It is a consideration that has not been applied by psychologists with sufficient exactitude. Unimpressive, as it may seem, to one with full understanding, it is of the most far-reaching significance. It is as follows. A thing in the outer world can be called by all of us by the same name. A table can be spoken of by all as a table. A tulip by all as a tulip. Mr. Miller can be addressed by all as Mr. Miller. But there is one word that each of us can apply only to ourselves. This is the word I. No other person can call me I. To anyone else, I am you. Likewise, everyone else is you to me. Only I can say I to myself. This is because each person lives not outside, but within the I. Similarly, in intuitive cognition, one lives in all things. The perception of the I is the prototype of all intuitive cognition. Thus, to enter all things, one must first step outside the self. We must become selfless in order to blend with the self or I of another being. Meditation and concentration are the sure means by which to approach this stage of cognition, like the earlier ones. Of course, they must be practiced in a quiet and patient way. Those who presume that they can violently or forcefully rise to higher worlds are mistaken. Giving ourselves over to such beliefs would be expecting the realities of the higher worlds to meet us, as do phenomena of the sensory world. The worlds to which we may rise are rich and vivid, yet they are also delicate and subtle, whereas the sensory world is coarse and crude. The most important thing to be learned is that we must accustom ourselves to regard as real something wholly different from what is so designated in the realm of the senses. This is not easy. It is for this reason that so many who might willingly tread the esoteric path are frightened away at the first steps. One had expected to encounter things like tables and chairs and instead finds spirits. But since spirits are not like chairs and tables, they seem like illusions. The only thing wrong is the unusualness. One must first acquire the right feeling for the spiritual world. Then one will not only see, but also acknowledge what is spiritual. A large part of esoteric training is concerned with this right acknowledgement and assessment of the spiritual. The state of sleep must first be considered if we are to arrive at any understanding of imaginative cognition. As long as we have attained no higher stage than material cognition, the soul truly lives during sleep but is incapable of perception in the world in which it dwells while asleep. In this world it is like the blind among material objects. Such a one lives in the world of light and color, but does not perceive them. But from the outer sensory organs, the eye, the ear, the ordinary brain activity, and so forth, the soul has withdrawn in sleep. It receives no impressions through the senses. Now, what is it doing during sleep? It must be realized that in waking life, the soul is continually active. It takes in the outer sense impressions and works upon them. That is its activity. It stops this during sleep, but it is not idle. While sleeping, it works upon its own body. This body is worn out by the activity of the day. This expresses itself in fatigue. During sleep, the soul occupies itself with its own body in order to prepare it for further work when it again awakens. We see from this how essential is proper sleep to bodily well-being. Accordingly, those who do not sleep sufficiently hinder their soul in this necessary repair work upon the body. The consequence must be that the body deteriorates. The forces with which the soul works upon the body during sleep are the same through which it is active in the waking state. But in the latter case, they are applied for absorbing the impressions of the outer senses and working upon them. Now, when imaginative cognition approaches in us, part of the forces directed upon the body in sleep must be employed in another way. Through these forces are formed the spiritual sense organs that provide the possibility for the soul not merely to live in a higher world, but also to perceive it. Thus the soul, during sleep, works no longer merely upon the body, but also upon itself. This work results from meditation and concentration, as well as from other exercises. It has often been stated in my writings about higher knowledge that the particular directions for such exercises are given only from one individual to another. No one should undertake such exercises independently, since only those who are experienced in this realm can assess the effect for one who withdraws one's soul work from the body and applies it in a higher way. Meditation, concentration, and other exercises lead the soul to withdraw for a time from its union with the sensory organs and to become immersed in itself. Its activity is turned inward. In the first stages of such self-immersion, the soul's inner activity differs but little from its ordinary inclinations. In its inner labors, it must use the thoughts, feelings, and sensations that belong to ordinary life. As the soul becomes accustomed to being somewhat blind and deaf to the material environment and to living within itself, it gains capacity for inner accomplishments. Accomplishments through immersion in the inner life bear fruit first in the sleeping state. At night, when the soul is freed from the body, what was stimulated in it by the day's exercises works on. Organs take shape within it, through which it connects with a higher reality, exactly as it had through the outer sense organs with the physical world. Out of the darkness of nocturnal surroundings appear the light phenomena of the higher world. Tender and intimate at first is this communion. It must be taken into account in this connection that for a long time, upon awakening, the light of day will draw a dense veil over the night's experiences. The recollection that perception has occurred during the night appears slowly and gradually. It is not easy to learn how to pay attention to the delicate formations of one's soul, which, during one's development, begin to mingle with the common experiences of daily sensory life. At first, such formations of the soul resemble what are generally referred to as casual impressions. Everything depends on learning to distinguish what arises from the ordinary world from what, through its own nature, presents itself as a manifestation from higher worlds. In a quiet, introspective, mental life, we must acquire this discernment. It is necessary first to develop a sense of the value and meaning of those intimate formations of the soul that mingle with daily life, as though they were, quote, chance impressions, close quote, but are actually recollections of our nightly communion with a higher reality. However, they vanish as soon as we seize these things in a crude way and apply the measuring stick of sensory life to them. It is thus evident that, through work in a higher world, the soul must withdraw from the body some of its activity ordinarily bestowed upon it with such care. It leaves the body to a certain extent self-dependent, and the body needs a substitute for what the soul had formerly done for it. If it does not obtain such a substitute, it comes in danger of mischief from harmful forces. For one must in this regard be clear that we are continually subjected to the influences of our surroundings. Actually, we live only through the influences of these surroundings. Among these, the kingdoms of visible nature come under consideration first. We belong to this visible nature. We could not live if there were no mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms or other human beings around us. Imagine an individual being cut off from the earth and lifted into surrounding space. Such a person would perish instantly as a physical being, just as one's hand would wither if cut away from the body. Just as it would be a great illusion if a human hand believed it could exist without the body, equally great would be the illusion of those who maintain that they could exist as a physical being, without the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms, and without other people. In addition to these kingdoms, however, are three others that generally escape people's notice, the three elemental kingdoms. They exist, in a sense, below the mineral kingdom. Beings exist who do not condense into the mineral condition, but they are nonetheless present and influence human beings. Parenthesis. Further information on the elemental kingdoms can be found in my book titled Cosmic Memory and in remarks about them in my title Theosophy. Close parenthesis. We are thus exposed to influences from kingdoms of nature that in a sense must be called invisible. When the soul works on the body, much of its activity involves regulating the influences of the elemental kingdoms so that they are beneficial to human beings. As soon as the soul withdraws part of its activity from the body, detrimental forces from the elemental kingdoms may take hold of it. This is a danger of higher development. Therefore, we must be careful that as soon as the soul is withdrawn from the body, the soul is accessible only to beneficial influences from the elemental world. If this is disregarded, the ordinary person deteriorates to a certain extent physically and morally, despite having gained access to higher worlds. While the soul dwells in the higher regions, pernicious forces insinuate themselves into the dense physical body and the etheric body. This is why certain bad qualities, which before higher development had been held in check by the regulating power of the soul, may now show themselves through lack of caution. When they enter higher worlds, people formerly of good moral character may under such circumstances reveal all kinds of low inclinations, increased selfishness, untruthfulness, vindictiveness, wrath, and so on. Those alarmed by this fact need not be deterred from rising to the higher worlds, but they must be careful to prevent such occurrences. Our lower human nature must be fortified and made inaccessible to dangerous elemental influences. This can be brought about by consciously cultivating certain virtues presented in writings on spiritual development. This is why they must be carefully sought. They are the following. First, we must, in a fully conscious way, in all things, focus continually on the permanent, distinguishing the imperishable from the transitory, and turning our attention toward it. In all beings and phenomena, we can suppose or discern something that remains after the transitory appearance has faded away. If I see a plant, first I can observe it as it presents itself to the senses. No one should neglect to do this, for anyone who has not become thoroughly familiar with the perishable aspect will detect the eternal in phenomena. Okay, I'm going to discuss this sentence. I think there's a word missing. Let me read the sentence again, then I'm going to read it as I think it should be, but it can be corrected on this. Food for thought for anyone listening. No one should neglect to do this. That is, let me read that again. If I see a plant, first I can observe it as it presents itself to the senses. No one should neglect to do this, for anyone who has not become thoroughly familiar with the perishable aspect will detect the eternal in phenomena. I think that's incorrect. I think it should say, no one should neglect to do this. For anyone who has not become thoroughly familiar with the perishable aspect will not detect the eternal in phenomena. I think the word not is missing, but I don't know for sure. End of aside by the reader. Those who fear that fixing attention on the spiritually imperishable will cause them to lose the freshness and naturalness of life do not really understand the nature of this process. When I look at a plant in this way, it can become clear to me that within it is a lasting, living impulse that will reappear in a new plant when the present plant has long since crumbled to dust. We must adopt such an attitude in our whole approach to life. Second, the heart must be fixed upon all that is valuable and genuine, which we must learn to esteem more highly than the fleeting and insignificant. In all feelings and actions, the value of any single thing must be held before one's eyes in the context of the whole. Third, six qualities should be developed: control of the thought world, control of actions, endurance, impartiality, trust in the surrounding world, and inner equilibrium. Control of the thought world can be attained by combating the wandering, will-o'-the-wisp thoughts and feelings that constantly rise and fall in ordinary human beings. In everyday life, people are not the masters of their thoughts, but are driven by them. Naturally, this must be so, for life drives people, and as practical individuals, they must yield to this. In ordinary life, there is no alternative. To approach a higher reality, however, at least brief periods must be set aside, during which we become rulers of our thoughts and feelings. In complete inner freedom, we place a thought at the center of the soul, where ideas otherwise thrust themselves upon us from without. We try to keep all intruding thoughts and feeling away, and to link only what we will to admit as suitable with the first thought. Such an exercise works beneficially on the soul, and through the soul, on the body. It brings the body into such an harmonious condition that it withdraws itself from harmful influences, despite the fact that the soul is not affecting it directly. Controls of actions similarly involves regulation of acts through inner freedom. A good beginning is to determine to do something regularly that one would not typically do in ordinary life, since people are indeed driven to their actions from without in normal life. However, the smallest action performed on one's innermost initiative accomplishes more toward self-development than do all the pressures of outer life. Endurance means holding ourselves at a distance from the whims that involve a shift from, quote, exulting to the highest heaven to grieving even unto death, close quote. People are driven to and fro through all kinds of moods. Pleasure brings gladness, pain brings depression. This has its justification, but those who seek the path to higher knowledge must be able to mitigate joy and grief. We must gain stability. We must surrender with moderation to both pleasurable impressions and painful experiences. We must move with dignity through both without being absent or disconcerted. This does not produce lack of feeling, but brings us to the steady center within the ebbing and flowing tides of life around us. We always have ourselves in control. Another important quality is positivity. This can be developed in those who in all things have an eye for the good, EYE. This can be developed in those who in all things have an eye for the good, beautiful, and purposeful aspects of life, and not primarily for the blameworthy, ugly, and contradictory. In Persian poetry, there is a beautiful legend about Christ that illustrates the meaning of this quality. A dead dog is lying on the road. Among those who pass by is Christ. Everyone else turns away from the ugly sight. Only Christ pauses and speaks admiringly of the animal's beautiful teeth. It is possible to look at things in this way, and those who earnestly seek it may find in everything, even the most repulsive, something worthy of acknowledgment. The fruitfulness in things is not in what is lacking in them, but in what they have. It is also important to develop impartiality. We have all gone through our experiences, and from them have formed a fixed set of opinions through which we direct our lives. Just as conformity to experience is, of course, necessary, on the one hand, it is also important that those who would pass through spiritual development to higher knowledge always keep an eye open for everything new and unfamiliar that confronts them. They will be as cautious as possible with judgments such as, quote, that is impossible, close quote, or, quote, that cannot be, close quote. Whatever opinions may have been formed from previous experiences, they will be ready at any moment when encountering something new to allow a new opinion. Love for our own opinions must vanish. Once these five qualities have been acquired, the sixth presents itself as a matter of course, inner balance and harmony of spiritual forces. We must find a spiritual center of gravity within that gives us firmness and security in the face of all the phenomena that would otherwise pull us one way or another in life. We must not avoid full participation in surrounding life, and everything must be allowed to work on us. Fleeing the distractions of life is not the correct course, but rather a fully devoted surrender to life with the sure, firm guarding of inner balance and harmony. Finally, quote, will to freedom, close quote, must come within the seeker's consideration. Those who find within themselves the support and basis of all that they accomplish already have this attribute. This is hard to achieve because of the balance needed between opening the senses to everything great and good and a simultaneous rejection of every compulsion. It is easy to say that outer influence is incompatible with freedom. The essential thing is that the two be reconciled within the soul. When someone tells me something and I simply accept it under the compulsion of authority, I am not free. But I am equally unfree when I cut myself off from the good that I might receive in this way. In that case, worse elements in my soul act as a compulsion upon me. Freedom means not only that I am free from the compulsion of an outside authority, but above all, that I am also not subservient to my own prejudices, opinions, sensations, and feelings. The right way is not blind subjection to what is received, but to leave ourselves open to suggestion, receiving it impartially, so that we may freely acknowledge it. an outside authority should exert no more influence than to make one say, quote, I make myself free just by following the good in it, that is to say, by making it my own, close quote. Authority, based on esoteric wisdom, will exert influence only in this way. It gives whatever it has to give, not to gain power over the recipient, but only to help the recipient become richer and freer through the gift. The significance of these qualities has already been touched on in the discussion of the lotus flowers in How to Know Higher Worlds. It showed their relationship to the development of the 12-petal lotus flower in the region of the heart, and to the currents of the ether body connected with it. From what has been said, it is now evident that these qualities enable the seeker to dispense with those forces that formerly benefited the physical body during sleep, and which now, because of one's development, must be gradually withdrawn from this task. Imaginative knowledge develops under such influences. The end of essay number 1.